supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Laura Benshoff, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller has the night off. Today is the last day of a controversial information-sharing agreement between Philadelphia law enforcement and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. You may remember that earlier this summer, an obscure database became a flashpoint in the city's ongoing conflict with federal immigration authorities. That database is called PARS, or the Preliminary Arraignment Reporting System. It's a way for Philly police to share information quickly with the courts and the district attorney's office. And for about a decade, ICE has also had access. In July, activists like Mara Anao staked out City Hall, calling for an end to that agreement.
It's just messed up that Philadelphia is a sanctuary city, but then it's still like giving information that is putting people in danger.
Mayor Jim Kenney announced the city would not renew its PARS contract with ICE after meeting privately with concerned members of the city's immigrant community. Here with me to talk about what the end of PARS really means is Philadelphia Inquirer opinion writer Abraham Gutman. Abraham, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
During the height of the City Hall protests that took place this summer, you wrote a column about what PARS is and how it works. And I'm wondering if you can just break that down. What type of info is in this database?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to remember is that although the slogan over the summer was end PARS, the discussion is not really about PARS, but about who has access to it. So PARS is a pretty obvious system. You have a person arrested by the police. Somehow the district attorney needs to know about that so they can decide to press charges or not. And if they press charges, somehow the court needs to know about that so they will be able to schedule a hearing to decide things like bail, extent of charges, stuff like that. So there's a system that each of those three entities can log into and see what's going on. That's PARS. Mm-hmm. The problem starts when in 2008 the city signed a contract with ICE, Immigration Enforcement, to allow them access to PARS. It's important to note that PARS does not have immigration status on it. And further, PARS has self-reported country of origin. The problem becomes that although there's no immigration status, because there are other databases, or ICE can try to, you know, check or see who is from X country, Y country that is currently arrested and then cross-reference. That is the fear.
What do we know about how ICE was actually using this PARS database? I mean, people use the word phishing a lot in describing sort of what the fear was about how federal immigration enforcement would use the information that it contained.
There was a weird moment in the opinion of the judge in the case of Philadelphia against Jeff Sessions that defended the sanctuary cities that he describes what the ICE officer that represented ICE said about PARS. And he kind of said that it's useless. Hmm. He's like, you know, it's a really old system. It's like this computer that sits here. We need to go. We have someone that needs to like check it all day. So he argued that it's not helpful to them. So I think on one hand, yes, it's probably not that helpful. On the other hand, it's one more way to remind communities that they're surveilled.
For some people, it is very cut and dry that if you break an immigration law, there should be consequences and that they should be enforced, you know, efficiently. And so I'm wondering why you came down on the side of this is a contract that should end.
So when people talk about breaking the law, there's a lot of law. There's a whole lot of law that is enforced in varying degrees in our city. We can talk about, you know, landlords that don't respect lead law and lead paint. And we don't talk about that as a country of law and order. You have to, you know, have to respect the law. But when it's immigration, somehow that is the conversation, as if it's the epitome of sovereignty, this ability to control your border.
Do you think things are going to change significantly after today, after the PARS contract ends?
I think, unfortunately, I do not. I think that there is importance in communities knowing that the city ended this and that knowing that the city heard them in a way of becoming a little closer to a full meaning of sanctuary, and yes, it's a good thing. If we will see a big drop in the amount of unconvicted, undocumented immigrants are deported, I unfortunately do not think so.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Abraham. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I appreciate you inviting me. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Philadelphia Inquirer opinion writer Abraham Gutman. Carrie Evelyn Harris is the progressive Democrat challenging three-term incumbent Tom Carper in Delaware's U.S. Senate primary next week. She's hoping to catch lightning in a bottle and topple a politician with 13 statewide electoral wins, the most in Delaware history. And today, Harris was joined on the campaign trail by a fledgling New York City politician who's already ousted an incumbent. WHYY's Chris Barish has the story of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's appearance with Harris.
Ocasio-Cortez became an overnight sensation June 26th by trouncing a three-term incumbent in the Democratic primary to represent parts of Queens and the Bronx in Congress. Harris helped her in that race, so the New Yorker returned the favor by stumping for Harris at the University of Delaware and a Wilmington Community Center.
Carrie was there. She had my back, and I'm here to have hers, because that's how the progressive movement really works.
Both support a $15 minimum wage, Medicare for all, and reforming the criminal justice and immigration systems. Ocasio-Cortez, a Democratic socialist, says progressives must unite citizens to make the government serve people's true needs.
When we build coalitions, when we break down barriers, and we show the importance of not just championing our own values, but championing the values of our neighbors, we can create an unstoppable force in our politics, and we can transform not just the Democratic Party, but really the United States of America.
Harris urged the 300 listeners at UD to research candidates.
Look at voting records. Did it serve you, your family, and your community the way that they were supposed to? Vote your conscience, not what other people are telling you. Change can come, but only if you choose it.
Senator Carper told WHYY this week that he always campaigns like he's 20 points behind, even as he tends to business in Washington. He said polls are encouraging and even alluded to working with Ocasio-Cortez in Congress.
I don't know her. I'm told she's a very impressive young woman, and so hopefully I'll get to meet her somewhere along the line.
Primary voting is this Thursday. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
This week, one of Philadelphia's largest construction unions announced plans to build a $25 million training center in North Philadelphia. The goal is to make both building trades training and jobs more accessible, especially for African American city residents. Jake Blumgart of WHYY's Plan Philly has more.
To get the training necessary to earn a union card and well-paying work, laborers' union members have to commute to the far-flung suburbs of Chester County. For a labor union whose membership mostly lives in the city, that long commute has always been hard. But laborers leader Ryan Boyer said the round trip has grown to almost 2.5 hours. Worse when traffic stinks. As family dynamics have changed, members can't spend that much time on the road.
And when it was built in the 80s, you know, men weren't expected to be a greater part of the household. Now the dynamic in the 2000s have changed. Both parents are working, so now you're expected to pick up the kid. I know I am.
In order to make life easier for the rank and file, Boyer's union is moving its training facility to North Philadelphia. The new center will take up half a city block on the site of the old William Penn High School. Inside its huge training bays, members can do everything from learn how to erect scaffolding to how to safely remove asbestos from a model house. Neighbors have embraced the proposal, but they are less thrilled about the union's alliance with Temple University, which sold the land to the laborers. Resident Priscilla Robinson Wood says she simply doesn't trust anything the university says, citing the controversial football stadium plan for the neighborhood. She fears what the laborers' project will mean for the remaining half of the former high school site, which Temple is holding on to.
You got a whole nother half a block right there. So I just need to know what else is going there, what the university's plan is.
To help sell the plan, labor leaders have promised that the community will be able to make free use of the space for banquets and meetings. Jake Blumgart, WHYY News.
80 years ago, in the summer of 1938, the colonial-era iron foundry, Hopewell Furnace, opened to the public as America's newest national historic site. WHYY's Peter Crimmins takes us back to what the trip might have been like for a Black family traveling through what could be a dangerously racial landscape.
Imagine an African-American family, 1938. They're itching to take a summer vacation. Suppose they live in Cleveland, where Dad works in a factory, and he got himself a good deal on a Hudson Terraplane with a radio. He wants to get the family out of the city for a couple days. So his wife makes some sandwiches, he piles the kids in the back, and he points the nose of that Terraplane to Pennsylvania, where the historic Hopewell Iron Furnace has just opened as a national park.
The
This family has a copy of the Negro Motorist Green Book. That was an annual atlas for African Americans to navigate the sometimes dangerous mid-century American landscape. It listed, by state, all the Black-friendly gas stations, restaurants, taverns, hotels, where a person of color could safely stop. It's a long drive to Pennsylvania, and they need to stop somewhere for the night. The nearest city to Hopewell is Reading. So they might consult their green book to see that there is just one listing in Reading, a tourist home on Buttonwood Road, run by Elizabeth Dawson, a woman now nearly lost to history.
I had not heard of her previously.
This is Bradley Smith. He's the curator of the Berks County History Center in downtown Reading. I asked him to hunt for any record of Dawson.
Unfortunately, we've never found, at least not so far, we've not found anything that she's written that we could know what her thoughts were. But we found quite a bit that tells us about the activities in which she was engaged.
Smith found that Mrs. Dawson, Elizabeth, was very engaged in Reading's African-American community. For 50 years, she volunteered at the hospital. She organized community picnics. She not only sang soprano in the choir of the Washington Street Presbyterian Church, but also in the Reading Community Choir.
I think that was not necessarily an African-American group. It was just a singing group, a desegregated singing group to the best of my knowledge. And I found that interesting because that was, oh, I believe, 1930s.
The next morning, our imagined family would have thanked Dawson for her hospitality and set out on the last 20 miles to Hopewell. The Hopewell Furnace was originally established in 1771. It made iron for the Revolutionary War. It operated by pulling water out of French Creek and sending it to a water wheel. The 21-foot wheel pumped a bellows that blasted air into a furnace where iron was melted at 2,300 degrees. National Park Ranger Frank Hebblethwaite says it's pretty cool to watch.
For a four-year-old boy or girl to see that giant wheel turning just by the weight of the water to provide a blast of air to the furnace to make it hot enough to melt rocks. It's like a man-made volcano. And that is exciting.
Our imagined African-American family visiting the Hopewell Furnace in 1938 would have learned a lot about the history of iron forging in southeast Pennsylvania, which was vast. There were many dozens of active furnaces and forges in the area at the time. What they would not have been told was that during the first years of the furnace, it was operated by slave labor.
Mark Byrd had a total of either 17 or 18 slaves.
Mark Byrd was the original owner of Hopewell.
That made him the single largest slave owner in Berks County.
Hebblethwaite is part of an effort to discover the African-American history of Hopewell, which is more than slavery. 80 years after it was founded, the furnace did a complete turnaround and became a site of emancipation. Records show that by 1850, it had become a prominent stop of the Underground Railroad, where fugitive slaves could get a job cutting wood to burn in any of the furnaces in the area.
Just huge swaths of woods. What better place to hide? If you're a runaway and you're headed north, you can very easily not just find a job, but find a job that's going to keep you in the woods until the threat passes, and then you can keep heading north.
Hebblethwaite says the owners of the furnace would have known this was happening. The historic accounting ledgers show some of the workers were hired for very short terms, sometimes just a few weeks. It's very likely the owners abetted the passage of fugitive slaves by putting some money in their pockets and sending them on their way. A lot of those runaway slaves came through Sixpenny Creek. That's a little community near Hopewell where the workers lived out in the woods.
Very thick, always was. Got to have some heavy pants on and something that stickers don't go through, you know.
That is John Cole. He's 77, and he has never lived anywhere else. His family has owned this land for about 150 years, a legacy of his great-grandfather, Isaac Cole. Isaac, who was black, as is John, was a woodcutter for the Hopewell Furnace. He bought land, and on that land he built an African Methodist Episcopalian church, Mount Frisbee. He's buried in its cemetery with about 30 others, marked with stones.
It seems like some of the stones are literally stones. I mean, they're not carved.
Right, and no names.
John Cole and his wife, Barbara, have spent years helping the Hopewell Furnace get the history straight.
The black folks working at Hopewell were either runaway slaves, freed colored men, you never really knew which, and sometimes they would stay and work a few days and keep on going north. Or sometimes they would settle here. So it was just, but there's no question that it was a part of the Underground Railroad.
That tiny community of Sixpenny Creek, which doesn't exist anymore, was more than a place to harbor fugitives. Barbara Cole says it was a place where workers of all races and nationalities lived side by side.
The people who came here, whether they stayed for 2 days or 3 days and worked at the furnace and continued to move north, whether they came and worked and settled, they were all looking for the same thing. They're just looking for freedom. They want to raise their children. They want their kids to be educated. That's really all they were looking for.
Our imagined African-American family taking their road trip to the Hopewell Furnace in 1938 would not have been told any of this, but they would have felt the legacy of the Cole family, because after a hot and dusty day of touring the historic iron forge, they might have gone to French Creek for a swim. In the 1930s, George Cole, John Cole's father, sold most of the family property, 70 acres, to the federal government so that this could become a national park. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Labor Day weekend represents a final farewell to the summer season before fall school and work obligations increase. But as the name implies, it's also a time to reflect on labor. Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, to do just that.
Frank, why don't we start with American attitudes toward labor unions in 2018?
62% and 6. How's that for two numbers? 62% is the percent of Americans who approve of labor unions. And I always like to point out, Dave, that this is one of the very first questions that Gallup started asking back in the 1930s. Way back in 1936, 72% of Americans responding to this exact same question said they approved of labor unions. Fast forward to today, it's 62%. It's varied some up and down over the years, but it's not that far below where it was back then. The sixth number I mentioned, that's the percent of Americans whom we just interviewed just a few weeks ago that said they personally were members of labor unions. Very small number overall. Yet despite the decrease in people who are members of unions, the idea of labor unions still gets significant majority approval by the American public.
Any hunches on why that might be?
Well, we think, of course, that labor unions represents the same type of thing that we see when we poll about minimum wages, the same thing that we get sometimes when we poll about guaranteed family leave and parental leave, all of which are scoring very high. I think Americans view unions as one way to try to keep the gap in incomes smaller than it is now. And we know, of course, that that is one of the big things that Americans think should be changed. They think the gap is too high right now. So when we say labor unions, I think a lot of Americans think, yes, that would be one way to help those at the bottom of the income distribution come up, even as those at the top are way, way up above where average workers are.
With that in mind, what percent of respondents say they're underpaid at work?
It's 43%, and that actually hasn't changed. We asked that back in 2010, and it was 43% as well. It was a little higher in August of 2008 when we first asked the question, and that was right in the middle of the recession, of course, as it was beginning. 51% said they were underpaid then. So when we ask workers across the country, 50% of us say we're paid about right, 43% say they're underpaid, and I should point out, Dave, 5%. How's that for a number? 5% of American workers will tell us they are overpaid for what they do.
And so then how does all this jive with a general perception that wages are not improving or keeping up with inflation?
Yeah, that's been a very constant drumbeat now in a lot of the economic literature that although unemployment is way down, the economy is doing very well, American workers still aren't seeing it in their paychecks because inflation is up. And, of course, the increase in the amount of money that we're paid hasn't gone up concomitantly. So we might expect to see that in our data, but we don't. Workers chronically are not satisfied necessarily with the amount of money they get paid. But nevertheless, that's actually gone up a little in recent years, not down. It bottomed out a little during the recession, and it's come back up. That is satisfaction with the amount of money I make. But we're not seeing any indication at this point on a couple of different measures that workers are becoming less satisfied than usual with the amount of money they make.
In a broader sense, does Gallup measure worker satisfaction?
We do, and most workers are satisfied with their job, and that's actually up some now as well. In fact, I also saw a conference board report where they asked the same question, and they had the highest worker satisfaction in the history of their asking the question. Now, we here at Gallup think that worker satisfaction isn't necessarily the only thing we should be measuring. We have an employee engagement score that we give workers. That is not just satisfied with my job, but people who are actively engaged in the job. And that's also coming up some, but that's still quite a bit lower. The point being that I can be satisfied with my job because I only have to work a little and I get to go home at 4 o'clock and I can, you know, play video games during office hours because I really don't have enough to do. That would make me satisfied. But that's a far cry from being engaged in my job. And managers and employers want employees who are engaged, not necessarily just satisfied.
I guess if you go home at 4, you beat the heart of the rush hour ride. What is the average commute these days?
50 minutes, round trip. And that number is actually up slightly. But stress on that commute actually isn't up as much. So in other words, commuting time has risen some to 50 minutes. But when we follow up and say, are you stressed by your commute? Just about 1 out of 5 say they are. And that's actually not as high as we've seen in the past. So I guess that's a little modified good news.
Frank, this week the nation mourns the passing of Senator John McCain and for many, the era that he represented. In what regard is he held?
When we last asked about John McCain before his death, he had a 58% approval rating, favorable numbers, and a 33% unfavorable number. Now, that doesn't seem hugely remarkable, but in today's environment, to have a 58% overall favorable number for a politician is pretty remarkable. He had a majority or higher favorable rating among Democrats, independents, and Republicans, and that's very unusual today.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We had production assistance this week from Edward Saakashvili. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, Adam Staniszewski, and Mike Villers. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Laura Benshoff for NewsWorks Tonight.